This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ever since the 2016 election, we've been pondering the obliteration of our norms. But seen in the context of history, that's normal. The First World War, the Depression, the Second World War, jazz, rock and roll, the Vietnam War, alienation, and the Internet. Keith Bybee, author of How Civility Works, says every generation of Americans has found a reason to bemoan the end of courtesy and respect. But the fact is, civility can be a tool of oppression.
Jim Crow segregation was surrounded and sustained by a racial etiquette. Martin Luther King spoke about this quite eloquently in his letter from Birmingham Jail. You don't call the wife of an African American Mrs. She always gets addressed by her first name. An African American male adult is never Mr. He is boy or John. In order to be a member of polite society defined by such a racial etiquette was to enact through your conventional good behavior a racial hierarchy. The sit-ins, which were in part efforts to change laws, were direct confrontations with that etiquette. It wasn't ever enough for the civil rights movement just to seek policy change. There had to also be social change. One form of civility extended to all races so that it would be possible for people to interact as equals.
Talk about then how etiquette violation can be a political tactic. You offer a really good example of what you call manner-based intimidation, the group called ACT UP.
That's right. So during the 1980s in the Reagan administration, as the AIDS crisis was becoming more and more manifest, decorum at the time precluded discussion of non-heterosexual practices. Decorum at the time also sidelined or marginalized expressions of grief or mourning in public spaces. ACT UP, to bring greater attention to the AIDS crisis and to demand a more proactive response from government, abandoned appropriate behavior. They staged these quite dramatic takeovers of town hall or city hall meetings and legislative hearings. They staged die-ins. This tactic initially was understood as counterproductive. The idea is that they should play along with the rules of civility that are currently in place. Today, it's called tone policing. When you confront someone who's engaged in protest or some form of obstreperous behavior, and you say to them, you'd be a lot more effective if you would calm down. And what it does, right, is it redirects the conversation away from the issue that the protester is trying to call attention to and says, no, the problem is not the AIDS crisis or the problem is not police brutality. Instead, the problem is your style of complaint.
Athletes taking the knee, denounced as unpatriotic and disrespectful.
Policing of tone, I don't think, is just atmospherics. It really is a way of conveying a different understanding of the respect that people are owed.
Mm-hmm.
It taps into fundamental issues.
From respectfully taking a knee to yelling at a diner to cursing out the president, I wonder if there is some sort of range, and can you distinguish among them, or are they all the same thing?
You know, there's no authoritative institution that tells us what civility is, that tells us how to update civility when time has changed. That kind of debate surfaces sometimes a deeper criticism that we should be without civility at all. Like, let's just say what we think. And the patron saint of this perspective is John Stuart Mill and his powerful essay on liberty, where it said, you know, we should have a contentious public culture. we should have people shouting at each other in restaurants.
He was deeply suspicious of civility as a tool of repression.
Accusing people of being rude or uncivil is a way of, in Mill's language, stigmatizing them as being immoral. Interestingly, Mill himself ultimately came down in favor of civility. He thought that there should be rules of temperate speech if they could be designed and implemented in a way that would give respect to all merited arguments.
And I thought he was a realist.
That does sound pretty soft-headed, right? And so you wonder, why would someone like Mill shift gears like that? Why would this hard-headed proponent of contention and disputation suddenly go wobbly? I actually think it grew out of his very commitment to robust, uninhibited, wide-open debate. What civility and really what good manners do are provide you a mechanism for conveying your integrity. He sought and he thought rules of temperate speech, which were more egalitarian and fair, would actually underwrite a free speech society.
But you've already argued that civility is political, and therefore the rules will always be determined by the powerful.
It's also the case, though, right, that politics is never finished. So it's a call to action because civility is constituted through political conflict. So get out there. Join the argument. Mill, in general, said you can go as far as you want so long as it doesn't hurt another person.
Finish up then with a certain paradox that you alluded to when you said that John Stuart Mill thought that civility was, in a sense, a reflection of character. And then you went and you quoted François de la Rochefoucauld, who said, hypocrisy is the homage vice pays to virtue. What he meant is, even if you're lying about how you feel, you're still behaving in a virtuous way, and that's better for society.
When we're honest with one another, we often discover not our true commonalities. What we discover is how much we really don't like each other. And if we're in that kind of society, which is riven with disagreement, yet we still need to get along.
Civility enables us to lie in order to get along. And what's wrong with that?
Right. Well, yes. Now, you can say, well, I don't want to live in a society where people aren't really telling me what they really think. And I think that that perspective is really held by only people who have never lived with complete honesty, which is very unpleasant. Civility gives us an easily deployable means for conveying a basic decency.
At the same time, you're okay with yelling at Kristen Nielsen in a restaurant.
Right. I contain multitudes, Brooke. Shouting in the restaurant is part and parcel of determining what will count as our baseline of respect we owe one another in public life. So that's part of the making of the sausage. Once the sausage is made, and this metaphor is going to break down pretty quickly, then people can pose with that sausage in a way that's inauthentic and hypocritical.
Okay.
Really? I think we should keep this in. I think this sausage thing could be big.
But the thing is that a lot of people worry about the slippery slope, but our rules of discourse seem to have ebbed and flowed forever.
It's not as if having gone in one direction, we can't go backwards. We've seen that our manners have become more inclusive and egalitarian over time. But having made that progress doesn't mean that we couldn't step backward. I don't think we're going to dispense with civility. I think we might radically change the way in which we operationalize it over time. But I don't think that we will shed the requirement for civility. I don't think it's something we get over. I think rather it's the means through which we realize our ideals of justice and fairness.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Keith Bybee is a judiciary studies professor at the Syracuse University School of Law and author of How Civility Works.
This is On the Media.